Welcome to the CCTA Wake Up Call Show. Thank you for joining us. We ask you to sit back and enjoy, I hope, an informative and meaningful session, and that we would give you good, pertinent information. My name is Bob Griswold.
Mary Griswold.
Senator Bob Brinson.
Alan Harrop.
Pat Park.
Kim Fink.
Glenn Fink.
As you saw, we do have Senator Brinson with us, and we appreciate your coming along, Bob, and just giving us a little bit of your time and maybe a year-end wrap-up of all the craziness of the year.
Yeah, we'll see what we have time for.
What would you say were the most important accomplishments of the North Carolina legislature this year?
I would tell you, starting with Prevention of Sexual Exploitation and Women and Minors Act that we passed, basically defined a man and a woman for the state.
Well, that's always
believe
a good
it or
idea.
Not.
Well, how's a woman defined?
Great question. Let's see. Female, a term that when used to refer to a natural person means a person belonging at conception to the sex characterized by a reproductive system with the biological function of producing ova. There you go.
All right.
That's pretty
that
good.
Was a nice way
forward.
That's a nice way of saying it without using the U word.
So that was the big part of that, but there were sections in there that essentially outlawed revenge porn, if you will. That was part of it. It further restricted schools from being able to put transgender children with other children on trips, bunking them together, those sorts of things. It also allowed parents to opt their children out of certain books and allowed mandated, I guess, then the teacher to assign a different book to the child. And it also mandated that libraries be put their offerings online so that parents could peruse and take a look at what was offered and opt their children out of certain books as well.
I'm sorry, but I'd forget the question. The libraries, at what level does that go down to? I mean, we have libraries in Cove City and I mean.
Well, it's not, it was the school library.
Okay, school, got it, thank you.
The school libraries specifically, not our regional county run and university, I guess, for that matter, libraries.
Okay.
But it also, the point I wanted to make was it included the libraries that teachers kept in their classroom as well. So the off the book kind of off the record libraries, it required them to register their books as well.
Are there any teeth in the law for consequences for schools that defy this act? Because just last week, in Charlotte, there was one of the members, I don't know if it was a representative or a Congress, but reading parts of books out of a Charlotte school.
Yes, that was actually Representative Jones at one of the Oversight Committee meetings. He's a chair of, and it was actually the Chapel Hill, Carrboro, I think, is the school system that he brought up and asked those questions of. And you bring up a great point. No, I don't think there are any teeth into it, but that Oversight Committee meeting last week showed that there needs to be. And there were a few representatives that basically threatened and said, if you don't comply, we are going to withhold funds. And so that's where we probably need to go back and tweak this to say that you would lose funding in doing that, because, as you know, the funding goes through DPI, which is led by a Democrat, and our laws are enforced by an attorney general, which is also a Democrat. So the legislature would have to do something on its own.
Okay.
There has to be teeth in it, because if not, there's always going to be a way around it, and then, unless there's a whistleblower, and
right,
then you wait.
That's right. One of the other big things is Arena's Law. That was passed and into effect. The most important thing that came out of that was essentially it eliminated cashless bail. And so, you know, which is also called a promise to appear. It also went into many different issues regarding mental health. If the judge, if the arresting officer thought that the defendant, you know, was mentally incapable or had mental issues, then they're required to bring it up to the judge, who is then required to mandate an examination. And then if there are issues, it's a mandated involuntary commitment custody order. So those are in there. One of the other issues was with it, particularly in Arena's case, was it was a magistrate that was doing all of this. And so now a magistrate is subject to suspension by the Chief Justice. And they also have to make a written findings of facts required based on if they're giving a suspension or removal. So that's there, and then they can be suspended for not doing that. So a couple of those loopholes that we closed with the Arena's Law.
Just asking a general question, but I know with the incident, I say the incident with Arena versus actually getting this law passed, that was an extremely short period of time to get a law totally through.
Yes, but. You know, having been up there a year and a half now, I have found that there are folks that are constantly working on laws. You know, I mean, I have a whole list of things that I would like to do. And so, and then also going to some of these conventions with organizations like ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative group where we actually bring policy ideas together and sample legislation and actually debate it amongst conservatives and have a model legislation at the end. So people have some of these things on the shelf and some of these things that they're already talking about.
And the incident just triggered it.
The incident just triggered it because then you have the political will to actually do something.
Right.
And so, yes, there are a couple of things in here, but I don't think for a minute that we were already starting to work on some of these issues. And then this just said, hey, we need to work on it now, as opposed to, you know, next session or something like that.
While I'm thinking about it, it's a little bit different vein, but federally we've tried to remove legislation where it doesn't make sense anymore. Do we do that at the state level at all between at our?
We have been. I heard a little bit about a 10-year review for different, and it was done by department, and it was a review of 10-year-old or more legislation, or not legislation, but rules and those sorts of things. So we kind of, I think we need to renew that, is what I'm hearing, because we've already gone through the first round, I guess, and we've got to go back and do that. But one of the other things I will talk about that we passed was the North Carolina version of the RAINS Act. And I am looking for my notes on that. But essentially what that required was if there was a rule that a department was going to pass, then based on how impactful it would be, it kicks it back to the legislature to approve. So it takes away some of the regulatory
power.
Yes.
And puts it back to the Congress, which...
General Assembly.
Yes. Yeah.
What I was saying, and just going off the top of my head trying to remember, if it was over a $10 million impact over 10 years, it was...
You can't sneak
Yeah, there we go. It says, I found it. For proposed permanent rule with an aggregate financial cost of $10 million over a five-year period, then all members of the board have to approve it unanimously. And I think if it's above that, then it has to go to the... There we go. If it's over $20 million in a five-year period, it does not go into effect until... the General Assembly ratifies it.
So would this have been in play with the Fisheries Commission when they were trying to stop the shrimp trawling? Would this come into play?
I would believe so.
Because you've got a regulatory...
If the Marine Fisheries Board was the one trying to do it, then yes, this rule would come into play.
Good.
I don't remember what the financial impact is for the shrimpers, but it certainly would fall along these lines.
Because I think that the regulatory places have gotten way too much power, and they're making laws, and they're not accountable to us.
Yes, absolutely.
We can't fire them. We can't elect them. We can't censor them.
Yeah, like I said, this was North Carolina version of the RAINS Act, and it's trying to curb the unelected bureaucracy and put hands back in the people that are elected that are subject to public review, if
that's
you will.
That's a good thing.
And that's those were the two top ones. The bottom one was aggregate costs of at least $1 million over a five-year period. Then the rule must be adopted by at least 2/3 of the members of that board. So we put some financial impacts in place and given different approval authorities.
So you're taking some things away from the bureaucracy and putting it back before the voters somehow, because you are responsible to the voters.
We're your representatives, yes.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. Again, we will be back in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for listening. This is CCTA Wake Up Call.
What's the largest gun shop in Craven County? If you said East 70 Pond, you are correct. Since Drew got back from the most recent gun show, new guns have been pouring in faster than they can open the boxes. The large showroom at East 70 Pond, slam bam, full of firearms. New guns and used guns, long guns and handguns. You will find weapons for self-defense, hunting, target shooting, and collectibles. The team at East 70 Pond is friendly, courteous, and knowledgeable, especially in the area of guns. If East 70 Pond doesn't have the gun you are looking for, they'll try to find it. If you want to do a gun transfer, E70 Pond will help you do it right. If you are looking to buy, sell, or trade a gun, there's no better place to do it than E70 Pond. Of course, E70 has tools, electronics, trolling motors, and a great selection of jewelry. But their specialty is guns. And we're talking hundreds of guns. Come see for yourself. E70 Pond, across from Craven County Fairgrounds, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business. It's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Welcome back again. Thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Bob, you are going to...
Well, Kim asked a question.
Okay.
Well, actually, Glenn asked the question. It was, is there any Doge-like activity going on in our house?
Yes. And so the Rains Act was part of that. That was future looking. But as far as looking back, we passed what's called the Division of Accountability, Value, and Efficiency, which was the DAVE Act. And essentially, it gave 45 new positions to the auditor and allowing them to conduct spot audits, you know, that need to be done. But also part of that was every state agency must report to the auditor an explanation of how that agency, including each division or office within that agency, utilizes public monies to execute its powers and duties under the law, and a description of all positions within that agency that have been vacant for at least 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then what we required him to do with that was to assess the continued need of each agency and the vacant positions within those agencies and present a report to the General Assembly by December 31st of this year.
Mm, that's good.
And maybe the money won't get spent and reallocated to something else.
Right. So this was the General Assembly's attempt to do a Doge-like review.
Yeah.
And cuts. And so essentially the General Assembly would take the money from those places where they no longer want to fund and get rid of. We know that a lot of the departments use their vacant positions as a slush fund.
Right.
And so that's why the General Assembly has had, over the last couple of sessions, a war against vacant positions, so that the priorities of the General Assembly are what's funded going forward. And so this is another effort towards that.
That's great.
Bob, one question I wanted to ask, does this program or is there anything similar that would be extended to the school systems? Because I suspect if you look at the reports that have come out over the past 10, 15 years, the percentage of administrative positions
Yes.
in schools has gone up dramatically, where the actual numbers of teachers in the classroom has stayed pretty much stagnant. So I was just wondering, is there any way to, is this going to address the schools, or is there any way of doing that in the future?
I don't think this is going to address the schools, because the bill is focused at the state level. And what you're talking about is at the county levels. But hey, what I would love to do is take a look at, you know, why do we have 115 school systems?
Yeah.
You know, to me, there's at least 15 there that are duplication of effort.
Yeah.
And so maybe we take a look at that. Maybe we take a look at, and I say at least that because some of the counties are incredibly small, and so maybe you...
And a lot of them are shrinking.
Consolidate some counties.
The population of children in the state is actually shrinking over what previous projections were.
Right. And so there's a thought there. And then one of the thoughts I have that I have not researched or looked into yet is, you know, a cap on the number of positions, you know, maybe by a percentage or a percentage of dollars or a percentage of positions. Mm-hmm. For each of those school districts in the central office, you just cap them. So that's one of the ideas I have, but, you know, haven't fleshed it out yet. But that's the type of thinking we've got to get to, because my problem is, you know, at the General Assembly, we get bashed so much about, oh, the teachers need raises, you need to pay them more, and they do deserve a fair wage. But there's so much other money that we're giving that goes in the wrong places, and they're taken from the teachers.
Right.
And while that is happening, we keep increasing the amount of money we spend on education every year, and the results go down.
Right.
The NEPA scores are going down. So at what point, and what are the metrics to figure out a return on investment?
That's They've been going down for at least 10 years. When we started looking at Common Core numbers, they've gone down every year.
And so I don't blame the teachers. That's not what I'm saying.
Right. It's the admin.
But there are some consolidations that need to happen. And, you know, many of the teachers don't even know that the General Assembly appropriates money for each school system for school supplies. And you know where they go? To the central office. But, you know, but that's a local decision that the General Assembly takes the blame for. So, you know, there's a lot to do there.
But even though for example, as you mentioned, the local counties have authority over the staffing, I guess, in the schools and so on, but the state government funds primarily is the funder of the teacher pay, right? So you do have control over the payment of teachers.
Well, let's take a step back. Because I think there's a problem with the way that the General Assembly funds teachers right now. And basically what we say is for every grade level, for every 20, for example, for every 20 students you have in elementary school, we're going to fund one teacher. Well, that doesn't necessarily work, because what happens when you have 25? What happens when you have 15? Mm-hmm. You know, that burden then falls on the school to figure out how to do that. Mm-hmm. We need to go to a per pupil model. And this is how much the state is going to pay per pupil in order to fund the teachers, fund the school supplies, fund the programs that they're going to do.
Right.
And that also gets to the problem that we have right now with students with special needs. Right now, we only pay a flat fee, no matter what your special needs are, and this is the way I understand it, we only pay a flat fee, whereas you have students that are coming in that not only need a special teacher, they need a nurse with them. Well, we're not paying for that nurse. That has to come out of the money that the county has in order to figure all that out, but we need a schedule based on the disability as far as how much we pay for that. So, and those are discussions we had before the beginning of this session, but that never came about because I don't think there's enough political will to do it, because the school systems think they're going to lose money.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen. It actually will be more fair and they'll get more money.
I was also going to ask, is there any special way of allocating money for bilingual needs, you know, within the various counties?
That I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know,
because there are certain school districts that really, really have
English as a second language. I don't know how those are funded directly. Yeah. But
so much federal funding comes with strings. That the strings are not paid for out of the federal funding, but they're paid for out of our local
funding. And that's where I don't think that the average person understands that the state pays for some things, the county pays for, you know, maintenance and facilities and any supplements to teacher salaries, and then the feds pay for certain programs. And so it all comes into that school system, and you have the board and you have a couple of finance folks that are trying to figure this out. And really what it shows up to us is it looks like you're putting it all in a bowl and you're just pulling things out until you run out of money. It's a very opaque process, but I don't think it is intentional. No. I think it's just in exceedingly complex.
There's a spider web of sources and uses of funds.
Yes. Right, and you can't trace a dollar through there because it gets added to and gets split up. And so one of the things I've been talking to some of my colleagues about, and one of the issues that they had in the Winston Forsyth County, where they're like $23-26 million in the hole, and part of it was because they couldn't produce the financial reports to let the board know what was going on. And so we're looking at maybe having a certification or at least continuing education for the financial folks that are running the finances for the school system so that they can produce these reports and know where what money's coming in and where it's going and that sort of thing. Because that's the beginning. You've got to figure that out. But going back to the per pupil model that I was talking about, that also increases transparency because you could say, hey, I know you are receiving this much money for my student because he or she is in AGT or he or she has this diagnosis. What are you doing with that money?
Yeah, I would just like to comment on something that I think may be impacting not only on the funding but on school performance is that, this happened probably 20 years ago or so when the parents of the special needs children, they were no longer satisfied with the special needs children being in special classrooms.
Right.
They wanted to put them in the regular classrooms.
Understood.
So what that has produced is a complication for the teacher. The teacher now, instead of teaching students that are at a similar level and capability of acquiring knowledge and learning, now they mix them in with these kids that actually are not able to absorb that material. And I wonder how much that has impacted on this deterioration in school performance, because you're making it doubly complicated for the teacher, because now the teacher has to teach at levels to students that really need a special, in my opinion, a special classroom. I never agreed with that, but it was really pushed by the parents because a lot of parents did not want to accept the fact that their children were not as normal as the other children.
Yeah.
That's what people are after.
One of the things that we did this year, too, was ban the use of electronic devices during instructional time. Each school system has to come up with their own plan on how to implement that, but that essentially is put the attention span back on the agenda so that teachers are not fighting with devices.
AI being so predominant, it's going to be more difficult for teachers even to discern what is actually done by the students. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's going to continue to get worse.
Folks, on that, we're going to take another quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. This is CCTA Wake Up Call.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
Dr. Jay Singleton and his staff spend a lot of time removing cataracts, and they are good at it. Dr. Singleton has been doing a high volume of these procedures for 15 years, and the state-of-the-art Singleton Surgery Center is bringing costs down for patients and participating insurance companies. For dedication, experience, and convenience, you can trust the Singleton team. Dr. Jay Singleton and the Singleton Vision Center is conveniently located at 3515 Trent Road in New Bern.
Just who are these people doing this CCTA program? people in the community that love this country, to protect individual liberty, and to preserve the U.S. Constitution and free enterprise system. To learn more, go to cctaxpayers.com. That's cctaxpayers.com. Join Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association and make your voice heard.
Welcome back again. Thank you for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Bob, you're going to take us down. What's this one now?
Shrimp Gate.
So.
And thank you for all your action on that.
Yes.
Well, it was the right thing to do. And but those of you that have no idea what Shrimp Gate is, it was a pretty popular topic back in the spring, where we had a bill that essentially came from the House, was trying to establish a more generous flounder and red drum season. And in the Senate, one of my colleagues added essentially what was going to ban shrimp trawling in the Pamlico Sound and out to 1 mile from the coast. So essentially putting many shrimpers out of business because they don't have the ships and the gear, the boats and the gear to go out that far and survive, essentially.
Beyond that, it also turns into a rocky coast.
It does. And so it's a different, not only do you have to have a bigger boat, but you have to have different gear too. So
didn't it include the inland waterways and estuaries as well?
Well, the inland waterways and estuaries are already regulated. There is a limit, and I don't remember what it is, as close as you can get to inland and estuaries. It's also limited. I don't think they can even do it on the weekends so that they don't come into interference with recreational boats. So there are already a lot of limits that exist. And so they're dealing with that. But so there was a pretty good debate on the floor on this bill. Senator Bobby Hannig had several amendments that we tried to get through in order to take out the shrimp ban amendment, but at the end of the day, it passed the Senate, and there were only four senators that voted against it. It was myself, Bobby Hannig, Senator Norm Sanderson, and Senator Mike Lazara. And all of the Democrats voted for it as well. And so that's something we need to remember. My understanding is they looked at it as an environmental issue, and so that was why they went for it as well. So I was rather surprised it was that lopsided. Coming out of caucus, I kind of knew we were the only four that were going to vote against it that were Republicans, but it did surprise me that every one of the Democrats voted for it as well. So, and then one of the things that Senator Hannig did is a procedural maneuver. Normally, so this was second reading of the bill and we voted on it. If there's no objection, they usually go right to the third reading and vote again and we move it on. Senator Hannig objected, which took it to the next day. Now you have to wait till the next day. But what that allowed those in the House to do was they couldn't vote it on Thursday now, and it kicked it to the following week. And so that allowed the time necessary to get the shrimpers and those supporting them and the House organized.
Get them activated.
Get them activated. And of course, they came out in force Monday and Tuesday at the General Assembly, and most people I have seen there, now I've only been there a year and a half, but I was told it was quite a few people for the General Assembly, and trucks going around the block.
Yes.
We were there.
I went out for a photo in front, you know, with a couple hundred people. And but it allowed them to have time to get organized to start lobbying the folks in the House. And since I'm not, you know, in the House caucus, my understanding was they essentially argued it down and voted it down in caucus. So when it came out, Representative Celeste Cairns was able to say the bill was dead.
It was a bipartisan argument against it, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that essentially is Shrimpgate. The other part of it was there was a bill introduced that essentially was a buyout bill that would have, if there were folks that were turning in shrimp tickets, it would have given them money to upgrade their equipment or upgrade their boat or choose a different profession. I don't remember voting on that, but maybe we did, but that one was dead as well.
You know, this issue has a lot of history, to the extent that if you go back and look at that, the whole idea of human beings being able to harvest wild animals, okay, for a food source, if you go back and look at it, historically, it's been episode after episode of exhausting that supply. The codfish used to be an industry that was very, productive. Went down almost nothing. Swordfish, they had these big swordfish boats where they'd have pull these lines that were 15, 20 miles long and harvest them. That went down. The clamming industry, I remember when I first moved to North Carolina, you could go out and you could do clamming around Cape Lookout, and you go out there and you could rake some clams. Then they invented these clam diggers that went through and harvested them mechanically, where you used to have to use the tongue. My point I'm trying to make is that I understand protecting the people who are making a living from these items, in this case shrimp. But I had a friend of mine go out on a shrimp boat, this is 25 years ago, and the bomber goes down. And he wasn't a professional fisherman, just happened to have a friend that was working on one of the boats. He came back, and this is 25 years ago, he said, you'd be shocked at the number of dead fish that are thrown over the side that they get rid of every time they haul that shrimp.
But that's not true anymore. Right. I'm glad you said it was 25 years ago. No, there are new nets
right.
there that have holes in them that allow the
bycatch
to get out and the turtles to get out. So I'd recommend going out a little sooner because there's very little bycatch now. Mm-hmm. And but that's one of the arguments that keeps coming up.
And I think, but like I said, I mean, if they've solved that problem, it's fine. But I think that in reality of it is, if you look at what's happened over a period of time, we have to rely on animals and food sources that we raise ourselves.
Well, I think I'm just going aside a little bit longer. We were down in Emerald Isle at a meeting when they were trying to shut down many of the fishermen, and they were asked about in different estuaries. They were asked, the board was asked, what kind of data have you used from the prior shutdown, and they had no response. So all of a sudden, they were dead in the water because they wanted to shut down more.
You said it was dead in the water, but I understand that it's tabled or some other terminology, and it could come back. So it's not dead, right?
It could. I mean, the bill is parked in the House Rules Committee, so it would be up to the Rules Chair if they want to bring that bill back out. But having said that, you know, the Republican caucus in the House has spoken that they don't want it taken back out.
Right.
And so my thought process is, and I think everybody else's is, until the caucus changes their mind, it's going to stay in House rules. And yes, it will sunset at the end of our session. So, okay. You know, when we signy die in December of 26, that bill's dead.
It'll be dead.
That bill's dead.
Yeah. Okay.
And along with every other bill that hasn't been passed.
Okay.
So... So it does have a shot clock, but yeah, it's December 26th.
Now, we're coming up on primary elections in the state of North Carolina. The primary elections are when?
March.
March 3rd.
3rd.
So when is the filing deadline?
Great question.
I think it's tomorrow.
Day after tomorrow.
Tomorrow the
8th or the 19th.
Friday the 19th at noon.
Okay. So at that point, we have a list.
And if you're listening to the show, you're too late.
At that point, we have a list of all the people who have filed.
Yes. At that point, you will. And the deadline has passed to remove your name if you filed and removed it. So it's quite interesting. I know the article that we talked about earlier before we started. There's an assembly article out there where there's a group of folks that are recruiting Democrat teachers to change their party registration to run against Republican leadership in the primaries. I think at the time of the article in September, there were about 12 that had planned to run against House members. There was one that was planning again to run against a Senate member. I have not gone back to see if those teachers have filed. The one I was paying attention to is here in Craven County, had announced that she was going to run against Representative Steve Tyson. She has filed, but she did not file as a Republican. She filed as a Libertarian. So we don't have to... worry about a primary on that right now, but it certainly calls into question our plans of organizations that you can't endorse or the party can't endorse during a primary, because it would be a significant event that, you know, somebody that just switched from Democrat is still very much very liberal. Not a rhino, but a liberal running in the primary. So we've got to start having those conversations to figure out how to address that. And maybe it is, you know, if somebody's in the primary that has changed their registration in the past year or something, we're allowed to do that and have that conversation.
It has to do with voting in the primary, too. I mean, we drafted a resolution out of our precinct one point, indicating that we don't believe independents should be able to vote in the Republican primary because you don't know who those people are. If your party should select, the members of your party should select the people going to represent that party, my opinion.
Well, I think we need to have closed primaries. As long as we are able to have the independents vote, there are a lot of Democrats that change their affiliation to independents so that they can pick a weaker Republican candidate.
Exactly.
And it's happened.
Okay. Folks, we're going to take another quick break to hear from our sponsors and supporters. This is CCTA Wake Up Call.
At Professional Auto Service, keeping vehicles in top form and running well isn't just their business. It's the passion of folks who work there. If baling wire and duct tape is good enough, don't go near them. But if you take pride in your vehicle and reliability is important, go to 2215 Country Club Road in New Bern and let Professional Auto take care of your vehicle. You'll be pleased. That's Professional Auto Service, Country Club Road, New Bern.
Other restaurants claim their food is fresh and fast, but are they friendly? At Moore's, you're treated like family the minute you walk into their doors. With locations in Winterville, New Bern, Swansboro, Moorhead City, and Jacksonville, we've been practicing what we preach since 1945. At Moore's, our barbecue is slow-cooked and smoked over real wood daily until it's so tender it's falling off the bone. Combined with our fresh chicken, cooked-to-order seafood, and homemade fixins, we're sure you'll agree. If it's not Moore's, it's less.
Since 1952, the North Carolina Fisheries Association has been working to ensure access for fishermen and consumers to enjoy fresh local seafood. The North Carolina Fisheries Association is for fair, science-based fisheries management for commercial and recreational fishermen. If you agree with this philosophy, become a member. For more information, log on to ncfish.org. For fresh North Carolina seafood, there's no better place than B&J Seafood, Highway 70 East in New Bern.
The County Compass is a rapidly growing, free weekly newspaper throughout eastern North Carolina. At the County Compass, we believe small business is the future of our great nation. Many small business owners have discovered that an ad in the County Compass each week is the most effective, the most affordable way to reach thousands of readers from all walks of life. At the County Compass, we focus entirely on local and regional news, coverage of important issues that directly affect your life. At the County Compass, we love our readers and we love our advertisers. This Thursday and every Thursday at more than 750 distribution points throughout eastern North Carolina, pick up your free copy of the County Compass newspaper.
Thank you again for listening to our sponsors and supporters. Bob, you're going to take us into the future, we hope, on your...
I hope so. I mean, there are still 6 bills out there that the governor has vetoed that still need to be overridden in the House. The Senate bills have already been overridden in the Senate because, you know, we have a supermajority in the Senate, but they're only have 71 in the House, so they're one vote short. So these will continue to be on the House agenda pending when they have the votes to bring them up. And the first one is Freedom to Carry NC, Senate Bill 50. Basically, that's the constitutional carry bill. That still needs to be overridden in the House. There's the North Carolina Border Protection Act. Essentially, that mandated that all of the state law enforcement agencies cooperate with ICE. Right now, if you remember, we passed the one that these sheriffs would cooperate with ICE. This was for DPS, for Highway Patrol, SBI. They would cooperate with ICE as well. That's Senate Bill 153. That still needs to be overridden. prohibition of DEI in state agencies. That is House Bill 171. Basically, get rid of promotions and everything regarding DEI at the state level. Again, House Bill 171. Senate Bill 227 eliminates DEI in public education. Senate Bill 558 is eliminating DEI in public higher education, so K through 12, and then in our universities and community colleges. Those are sitting in the House waiting to be overridden. And then the last one is House Bill 87. If you recall from the One Big Beautiful Bill, it talked about giving tax credits to people that donated to kids' education accounts, but the state had to opt into that in order to do that. And so that was us opting into that program. So those are the ones that still need to be overridden.
What is the time frame to be able to override them in the House?
So same deadline as any of the other bills.
End of 26?
End of December 2026.
Okay.
Before we sign it. So you have the short session, which is going to start April 20th and runs until we run out. I assume the end of June sometime, but we'll probably put sessions on once a month like we have now. And so we'd have until December.
Are
any new bills allowed to be introduced in the short session?
The
non-finance, is it?
The only bills that are allowed to be filed in the short session are local bills. And then also those finance bills, which, newer taxes or getting rid of taxes, and any constitutional amendments. So it is very limited what we can file new. Mm-hmm. Now, all the ones that have filed and made the crossover deadline of last year, all those bills are still in play.
It's still in play.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever pass a budget?
We have a budget.
From last year.
Did you pass a new budget?
We do not have a new comprehensive budget.
Okay.
But in statute is a continuing resolution which basically funds, it takes out all the non-recurring funds and funds all of the departments at last year's levels. So there already is appropriated $32 million. That is that budget and then all the mini budgets that we have done. And our cap most likely is around $33 billion. So we really only have about $640 million left to appropriate. You go back to some of the facts are, if we were to give every employee of the state, including all the teachers, a 1% raise, just a 1% raise, that's $197 million. That's a third of that.
Wow.
And, there are many people that are advocating for more raises than that, percentage-wise, for our law enforcement, for our teachers. We need to do all of that. And, we probably need to look at raises for our state and local retirees. $640 million doesn't go very far when you're talking about all of that. So that is kind of where the arguments are as far as how far do we go and how do we do it.
Looking forward, Bob, I know that there's a new committee that was formed in the House that has to deal with looking at property taxes.
They met today. So.
Okay. Could you tell us what they're looking at and what it could potentially do? What's the objective?
Honestly, since it's a House committee, I'm not real sure where they want to go with this. And I was going to look at the recording of their committee meeting this morning to kind of see where they're going. What I'm thinking about is the problem with property taxes really comes with the Democrat-run cities and the Democrat-run counties. The problem we have had here is my district, City of Washington and the City of Kinston. They raised their property taxes during a revaluation. As you know, we talked about revals last year because Craven went through one. But they didn't go back to revenue neutral. They raised taxes. And so most of the incumbents lost their municipal election this last fall.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
That's the way it's supposed to work, exactly. But what we're talking about, is areas like Durham and Chapel Hill and Orange County and Wake County and, Greensboro, those areas that have raised taxes, but they're not really providing that many more services.
And I think that's what's happened, like down in Florida. Governor DeSantis, he is addressing the same issue. And the point he made was that the counties, because the property values have been going up so much, if you look at the cost of housing over the past 5 years, that even if they kept the rates the same, the amount of money they're collecting goes up. So it gives them more opportunity. And so he wanted to kind of counterbalance that. And I guess that's what you're saying in these certain areas, that they're using that to revaluation plus the fact that the value of the houses are going up.
Right. But that's not true. Well, that's not true revenue neutral. You lower the rate to a revenue neutral, so you're only bringing in the same amount of money.
If the county does that, but they don't all do that.
They don't all do that.
Well, the issue I see with property taxes is as we're aging and we get our homes paid off, we really never own our homes because the property tax continues to go up. And there are senior citizens on their fixed income or their retirement income who are going to be taxed out of their homes. And something has to be adjusted. I don't know if there's a homestead exemption. I know some states have that. But, you know, just looking at the impact of the property tax on a retirement income.
And that's what I think they should be talking about. You know, whether I don't think we should go as far as Prop 13 from California, where you only set the valuation every time it's sold. I'm not sure we need to go to that draconian, but we do need to look at our exemptions again, because right now the exemption is so low, there are very few people that qualify for it. You know, perhaps we go to, if you're receiving Social Security SSI, you know, which is a proof of disability, then maybe, okay, we look at, so that's kind of where I'm going in my thought process. Or maybe we cap counties and municipalities, and they can't raise taxes more than 2% a year, you know, gross. And so, you know, basically giving them caps so that they won't tax people out of their homes.
Right.
But those are the ideas that I think the House is starting to banter around with this.
Well, the Senate's going to have to do their own.
Well, we will, but I mean,
with that too.
Well, that's true. But, you know, I'm open to all ideas, you know, because sadly, you know, the government still needs money in order to function, in order to provide services. But that's only half the equation. Spending is the other half.
Spending's the bigger part.
And that's where, yeah, and that's where we need to get back to. I don't think we ever done it, so back's probably the wrong. We need to get to zero-based budget.
Yes.
At the state level.
Agreed.
And there are a few of us that are talking about that, because right now all you do is you argue about how much government's going to grow, but you never go back and say, well, we don't need these services anymore.
That's where
and
the
that's
Doge
what you
comes
do.
Yes.
Well, not just Doge, but, you know, I was talking about the 10-year look back to all of the rules. I think we ought to establish every 2 years, every budget year, we go through at least two departments on a zero-based budget, and we start from the ground up. And that way, over 10 years, every department gets looked at from a zero-based budget, and you're not just adding two every year. You're actually starting to cut.
Well, I hope that in the future, as we go develop these possible exceptions, for example, the property tax and these other issues, I'm almost always opposed to it being income-based, because what you are doing is you're introducing the socialist notion that those people at the lowest level get the most benefits, and that unfortunately motivates them to stay at that level because they're not incentivized to increase their income because they begin losing some of the benefits they're getting. And I think it's these things should be across the board so you don't penalize people who are working the hardest and contributing the most. They get the least benefit from some of these regulations and laws.
One of the rare smart things that Massachusetts did when we lived there was something called Proposition 2.5, where the counties and cities and towns were limited. They could not increase their property taxes more than 2.5% without an override vote from the community. And it, I mean, Massachusetts is known as Taxachusetts, and that's, there's a good reason for that, but it did help slow down the ridiculousness of the growth.
Yeah, and that's another idea.
And I liked your idea that you mentioned earlier, Bob, where you mentioned about the funding for the school system should be based on pupil. And the advantage of that, and I think at some point, and I don't know what all the ins and outs of the resistance that is, but we have a lot of homeschoolers. They're homeschooling their students, and they are making a sacrifice and a commitment to do that. And they are actually saving money for the school system because there's fewer students, but they get essentially no compensation for that, and they ought to get the same compensation as the ones who send their kids to private schools.
Yeah, the problem with that, though, is with Democrat regimes, the strings come with them. And you got to think about both sides.
Bob, first off, I just want to say thank you very much for joining us for this show and giving us a little bit of insight as to what's going on in the legislature. I know you spend a lot of time there. And again, my condolences on the Army-Navy game, but that gave him
yelling and screaming is why I've got a bit of a raspy voice today.
But again, folks, I just want to tell everyone you have a very, very happy and Merry Christmas and
Happy Hanukkah.
And Happy Hanukkah and be safe out there. This is CCT8 Wake Up Call.